You ready to rock and roll?
It's easy.
I am. Yep.
Joe, see.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. With that gavel, I have convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for February the 28th, 2017. We are gathered today for the purpose of public hearing. And public testimony on House Bill 5007, the Employment Department budget. Mm-hmm. And with that, Ms. Deister, if you would tee us up,
okay,
and then we'll invite the agency up.
Today, I believe you're going to hear again from Ms. Erickson. You're also going to hear from David Gerstenfeld, who is the UI administrator, and from, because we didn't get to them yesterday, you're also going to hear from Gary Tyler, who is the Chief Administrative Law Judge with the Office of Administrative Hearings and the CFO's office. And all of that is before we get to public testimony, with the goal, of course, of getting you all out of here by 2:30.
Cool. How many is the sign-up sheet out?
It is.
Yes.
Okay.
And there are six people on it.
People on it right now. So, Ms. Erickson, will you come forward? And how long do you think the totality of your presentation will take?
I only like have 90 pages left.
Yeah.
40 minutes, maybe?
Okay, good. That will leave us adequate time for public testimony. So, welcome.
I am. Coach Johnson, Coach Argomber, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Kay Erickson. I'm the director of the Oregon Employment Department. Thank you for having us back today. As you just heard, today you will hear from me, David Gerstenfeld, and Gary Tyler. And at the table with me today is David Gerstenfeld. He will kick us off in a minute. Also at the table with me is Michelle Lisper from the DAS Chief Financial Office.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Johnson and Gomberg, members of the committee. I'm David Gerstenfeld, the Unemployment Insurance Division Director at the Employment Department. The Unemployment Insurance Division has three functional groups, and to give a high-level overview, we have one that handles the payment of benefits, one that handles the collection of taxes and the payroll reports that employers file, and a third that does a lot of the policy and federal and state compliance and quality control work. So that's a bit of an oversimplification, but that's in a broad sense how we're organized. The unemployment insurance program is there primarily as a safety net for people who lose their jobs, so it's a temporary partial wage replacement to help those workers and their families. It's also there to help the communities that they're in, both to stop the downward spiral when you have a large unemployment rate, and also to make sure that when economic conditions improve, that there is a trained workforce there ready to take the jobs that businesses need to fill. One of the increasing focuses of the unemployment insurance program in the past several years has been to go beyond that historical mission of just being a safety net and to also work more closely with the rest of the workforce system to help people get back to work so that they don't need to rely on the safety net as often or as long. And I'll be talking about a couple of ways that we're doing that in Oregon. The key drivers for our program are really the size of the workforce and economic conditions. So during a recession, we get a lot more work. During periods of economic growth, our workload goes down. We do have regular seasonal fluctuations that we affectionately refer to as the winter workload, and we'll be able to see that on a chart that shows our activity in a minute. But another key driver for us is the demand for specialized programs. And these range from temporary ones. For instance, during the recession, there were a number of different benefit extension programs. And then we also have some permanent special programs, including WorkShare, which is a program designed to help businesses avoid layoffs during temporary downturns. We have self-employment assistance that's designed to help unemployed workers start up their own businesses. Some of those more specialized programs can be a little bit more labor-intensive to operate.
I'm going to stop you right there. Could you provide the committee some additional detail on how you encourage entrepreneurial startups? Those are fraught with difficulty, and I would like to know a little bit more about how you select those that have any potential for success. What are the outside dollar amounts that you would provide? What kind of coaching? I'm wondering also how much of this is duplicative because you've got small business centers and others. So tell me what happens in that line of work for you guys.
Certainly, Coach Johnson. And actually, we partner with those small business development groups because we do not have that expertise. So the big screening criteria that we have is federal law requires that we only let people into that self-employment assistance program who, using a modeling method, appear likely to use up all of their unemployment benefits and still not be back at work. So from that population, there is a screening process where people give us some very basic information about what their plan is. Historically, we actually had the SBDCs evaluate those plans, and when they had resource constraints, we worked with them, and they designed a tool for us to use to do an initial high-level screening. If the plan looks okay, using that screening method, and it's really checking for basic things like, have you thought through basics of the business model, then we do approve them, they do go, and they actually work with the SBDCs and with other groups that have specialized expertise to provide that assistance. The only monetary investment that our program gives is paying the regular weekly amount that they would otherwise receive as regular UI benefits.
Okay. Do you know if there's any other money from any other sources that crosses palms? My curiosity is that I've had, over the time of my service in the legislature, so many people come in and say, is there money for me to start a business? And I say, do you have a business plan? Do you have a checking account? Have you filed all your requisite corporate documents? No. And I'm just wondering, who makes the decision that for somebody who's going to exhaust all of their benefits and still not go back to work, what's the potential viability of any of these entrepreneurial startups?
So it's a hard thing to measure, and as I'm sure you know, Coach Johnson, a lot of startups do not succeed. When we've looked at the data historically, Oregon has actually had a pretty high success rate, and I don't have those statistics off the top of my head. In terms of the money that they receive, because there do tend to be lots of different paths that funding might be available, we don't do much matching of that. We really do refer them to the SBDCs to find out what resources may be available. The one exception is we are involved with a pilot project with the U.S. Department of Labor. It's just in the Portland metropolitan area. They chose four metropolitan areas in the nation, and they're providing small amounts of seed money at certain parts of the process.
What's a small amount of seed money?
The maximum that they can give is $1,000.
Okay. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And Mr. Gerstenfeld, you're so good with numbers. I wouldn't be surprised if you know the answer to this one. Do we have a sense of how many potential entrepreneurs we are sending to the SBDCs each year?
I don't have that number off the top of my head, Coach Gomberg. I apologize. It's about 1.5% of the people receiving benefits, give or take. It does tend to shift depending on the economic cycle. So we saw a lot more people trying that during the recession when it was a lot more difficult to find a job and a lot more people were, as a result, trying to start their own business.
And I'm sorry, follow up. And on average, how many people are receiving benefits?
We received about 35,000 claims for benefits last week. So not all of those people would receive benefits, but that's a ballpark figure.
All right. Thank you. I can extrapolate.
500.
Yeah. Okay. I guess I'm curious, has the SBDC network ever shared with you how burdensome those referrals are to them? They're constantly in a state of lamentation about how little money they have. Do you provide them any resources to take on this referral load?
Coach Johnson, we have had those discussions, which is why they helped design that initial screening tool for us to take some of that initial brunt off of it so that there was some screening. The only resources that we provided is we did receive a federal grant from the U.S. Department of Labor a few years ago to provide a small amount of counseling, essentially, to help people that are starting their businesses. And we had that money go out to the SBDCs so that they could actually provide that because, again, that's not our area of expertise. So we were able to be a funnel to provide those resources. It was not a huge amount in terms of the overall work that they do.
Was it pro rata, or did you pick winners and losers in the SBDC world?
We tried to make it available for every group, and we looked at what the claims load was in each area, and if one particular region didn't use up all of their available funding, then we made it available to the other regions.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. So Most of the contact that we have with the public is through three locations. We have a contact center in Bend and in Beaverton, and a large number of staff in our central office here in Salem. We also have some tax auditors scattered throughout the state. This is just to show that even though we do work primarily out of a few locations, we do serve people throughout the state of Oregon. So there were about 230 claims for benefits filed last year, and this map just shows how many of those were in each county. The UI program is a partnership with the federal government.
When you go back to the last slide, when you see the 230,000 claims and you've spread them over the counties, do you have anybody in your shop that correlates that with general economic activity, or do you draw conclusions from the clusters? Maybe your economic team does that, but draws conclusions from the clusters of where the claims were and what was going on the ground in terms of the economy of those places?
Coach Johnson, we don't do that type of analysis within the UI division, but we do share that data, as you suggested, with the research division, and they use that to do analysis of more local economic conditions.
Okay, thank you.
So I'm going to try to give just a real quick high-level overview of how the money flows in the UI system. In Oregon, I said that we collect the UI taxes. We collect that state tax. It goes into a federal trust fund. It's held by the federal government for Oregon's use to pay benefits to workers. It doesn't pay for administering the program. Most of that administration money comes from a grant from the U.S. Department of Labor. We are very careful to make sure that we're consistent with the federal requirements for the UI program. There's a general framework that we have to stay within, and then there is leeway to have some variation between states. If we were to not be consistent with those federal requirements, the consequences can be pretty severe. So for us, we lose the federal administrative grant to operate the program. For Oregon businesses, they could lose a tax credit that they receive against their federal unemployment tax, the FUTA tax. And the impact of that on Oregon businesses would be about $500 million a year in additional payroll taxes. So we work very closely with our federal partners to make sure that we don't run into those types of consequences.
What do you do in the instance, and my memory is a little murky on this, there was a pretty significant overpayment in UI at one point in Oregon's history. As I recall, this was maybe a couple of biennia ago, $25 million. Am I remembering that correctly?
Coach Johnson, overpayments is something that has been an issue for the unemployment insurance program nationally and in Oregon. A lot of that, there's kind of two big variables, the overpayment rate and the number of benefits being paid. We've been working on both of those, so the economic improving has cut down significantly on the amount of benefits being paid, and then we've also been working very hard to reduce the overpayment rate in Oregon.
And I'd like to know more about that, and I'd like to know how aggressive you are in going after people who have been overpaid. And I understand there's an argument on both sides of that. I was overpaid, it was their screw-up, and I spent the money, and you can't get blood out of a rock. I get that. But I also am curious about how aggressive you are in going after those kinds of errors and what kinds of prophylactic measures you put in place to avoid that from happening. It's, to my way of thinking, it's a drain on the system, and other beneficiaries may be disadvantaged by incorrect overpayments.
Coach Johnson, it is a challenge, and our primary focus is on preventing the overpayments first, because as you pointed out, that's the least impact to us, giving us more resources to administer the rest of the program, and it's not as burdensome on people who receive benefits and then are told that they have to pay them back. So we have a number of things. We are constrained somewhat because of our computer system, so a lot of the overpayments during the recession, when there were big changes in how the program was run with all of those extension programs, we had our COBOL programmers working night and day to make those changes in the system. It did result in more overpayments as there were new programs being rolled out. We have built a number of stop gaps so that we can catch those. We can catch them more quickly. One example is we did get legislative authority several sessions ago to collect data from county jails. So we get data from them every week. And before we issue payments each week, we compare the people that have claimed benefits to the people that are incarcerated, and make sure that we're not paying benefits to people that are in jail and so not likely to be able to accept a job if it was offered. And that's been quite successful in significantly cutting down on those overpayments happening to begin with. So that's one example. There's not one single approach that you can take to fix it. We are pretty aggressive with our recovery, and as you pointed out, there are competing interests. The way that it's set up in UI is when people have intentionally given us inaccurate information, we have a number of collection tools. We work with the Department of Revenue and the IRS to intercept federal tax refunds that people might be entitled to. We work with them on voluntary payment plans. We can garnish bank accounts and wages, put liens against real property. We have quite a few tools that we can use. If it's an overpayment that was caused by a hearing decision or some sort of other error that was not the claimant's fault, then by statute we're only allowed to collect that by offsetting against future UI benefits they would otherwise receive.
How aggressive were you in going after the $20 million of a couple of biennia ago?
So, Coach Johnson, it's a little difficult to track individual payments over time with our systems. There is a federal standard for the collection rate where the U.S. Department of Labor expects states to collect at least 68% of the overpayments. Our collection rate is at about 85%, so we're doing pretty well there.
Good. Representative Gumber.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I know we've got a time schedule here, but you opened the door on a subject I'm particularly interested in. And
I knew that.
And so I wanted to pursue this a little deeper, if I could. I understand that you're pursuing robust efforts to collect either overpayments or also to pursue the revenue that is owed by employers that hasn't been submitted. But I'm looking at the overall trend in numbers. In 2014, $147 million. In 2015, $156 million. This past year, that went up to $161 million. So despite our robust efforts, the uncollected revenues are still continuing to gradually rise. What do we need to do to turn those numbers around?
Co-Chair Gomberg, thank you. And I believe that we have turned that around. I think that the most recent number that you're referring to is probably from the statewide accounts receivable management report that was filed with the legislature.
That's correct.
At the end of that fiscal year, so at June 30th of 2016, the amount that was owed to the Employment Department was about $162 million. At the end of calendar year 2016, 6 months later, that was down by $17 million, or 10.5%, to $144.5 million being owed. So we have turned that around. We're using more tools. We are using our business intelligence tool that lets us use our data a little bit better to choose which accounts to track. And we also are adding some more types of debt to that Treasury offset, intercepting the federal tax refunds. The biggest challenge that we have is knowing which accounts to work on, and that a lot of our processes are very manual, very just human intervention intensive.
Madam Co-Chair?
Follow up.
Well, I'm very pleased to hear that that the 161 has been reversed. That's positive news. So let's have fun for just a moment. And if I were to say to you, we want to put a serious dent in our delinquent debt in your department, all I need to make that happen is what? What do you need in order to turn this around big time?
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, I think the biggest issue right now would be having some sort of case management system where we could actually manage the accounts that erode. Modern systems have some sort of automated triaging where it will automatically flag accounts at a certain amount of time. It can track them. It can apply criteria to decide which accounts are more likely to be collectible, kind of a rating of those debts. We do not have any automated way of doing that. We've pieced together what we can. But the debts themselves, the cases, there's no core case management system for them. So that's probably the biggest impediment. Some other things that we've talked about, I mentioned that we do have the ability to place liens against real property. In Oregon, that requires us to place a lien in each county separately. So we do not do that as a matter of course on all debts because, frankly, it would be cost prohibitive and very labor intensive for us to do that. So one thing that has been discussed, and there have been prior legislative discussions about the possibility, is a centralized lien registry for real property in all counties in Oregon.
Representative Gomberg, you got another question?
Well, I had a couple. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. You know, I listened to your answer. You're talking about case management, and I'm not sure whether you're talking about people or whether you're talking about IT. What's the real answer there in terms of how we do what you just suggested?
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, both of those would help. I think, frankly, there's more bang for the buck with a system that would let each staff person that we have doing that work get through a lot more cases. The big challenge is with all of the accounts that are there, knowing which one, when I sit down to do my work each day, which ones I should focus on, and in what way I should try using various collection methods.
Madam Co-Chair, this is a fascinating subject, and I think the Employment Division is making some efforts here, some positive efforts, but they still tend to be at the top of the list in terms of agencies that are challenged by dated debt. I think one of the things we need to talk about here is how to build this into a key performance measure so that we can actually invite the department to give us regular feedback and progress on this particular subject.
Well, you have my agreement on that as the co-chair. Representative Nierman.
I just want to comment to just follow up on the train of thought that my friend Representative Gomberg had. I think what we need here is the department, I believe, is going to ask us for a new case management system, for a software system to do that. And what I'd like to do is to have a limited duration key performance metric that reflects on the performance of that that software project. So they're going to come and say, if you give us this project, we'll be able to collect all this debt and all that. And so I'd like to be able to go at the end of this software project or after it's installed to go back and say, did it do anything for you that you'd like to do? So I'll be talking with you about that.
My response to that would be if Co-Chair Gomberg agreed to have a budget note that mandated a report rather than putting it in the key performance measures that tend to kind of blend. This is a very big deal.
Yep.
And I'm going to ask Ms. Deister to capture that thought, something to discuss with the big co-chairs. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you again, Madam Co-Chair, and thanks for spending some time on this provocative subject. The delinquent debt we have comes in part from erroneous payments to benefit recipients. It also comes from employers who are not meeting their obligation to send in their tax payments. Do we have an effective system with those employers to verify that while they may owe you money, that they are not getting paid by the state of Oregon, by other departments for work that they're doing or services they're providing to the state of Oregon? Are we cross-matching the money owed with the money paid?
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, I'm not aware of a system in place in Oregon that would allow us to do that. So we do work closely with other agencies, and we've been involved with discussions about doing that. But at this point, there's not a system in place where we can go and share data with all other agencies about who owes us money to see if that business might be a vendor.
I want to revisit this a little bit more. Representative Holvey, some time ago, and I don't profess to be an expert in this issue area, I think passed a bill that required there to be some kind of agency coordination.
Co-Chair Johnson, I think you may be referring to the Interagency Compliance Network.
I am.
So that is a group of agencies, and it does require us to collaborate. It's not so much on the collection piece. It was more on the education and initial enforcement, with the idea being that if we have auditors that go out and see someone that is erroneously saying that employees are really independent contractors, that we don't just look for monies that are owed to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, but that we also work with DCBS to make sure that they're being covered by workers' compensation, that the Department of Revenue knows so that they can ensure there was appropriate withholdings made in transit taxes. So it's really more on the education to help people comply voluntarily and the enforcement piece to find and track down where people are not. On the collection piece, it's a little bit more difficult. Many agencies use the Department of Revenue's other agencies' account system. We use them, for instance, for the offset against state income tax refunds. So there are some areas of overlap, but not the type of what's referred to as a vendor offset that Co-Chair Gomberg was asking about.
Who owns that system? Who manages it? Is it a DAS function?
Which system are you?
This compliance system.
There is no system for the Interagency Compliance Network. It's a statutory group of agencies, so we work together, but there's not a separate system itself.
Who is the convener? Are there records of your meetings? Are you meeting? Are you collaborating? Are you doing anything out of this?
Yes, Co-Chair Johnson, we are. The convening function has rotated. Initially, it was with the Department of Revenue. When they started their core system replacement, the Employment Department took that over. So we've been doing that for the past few years. We do have regular meetings of both a leadership group. We also have an enforcement group and a communications group.
Could you provide the professional staff the next dates of those meetings? I would be interested in seeing how they work. And it seems to me that if we're busy on the regulatory side, we ought to be busy on sharing the other information. I personally, and I think others, have a sense of outrage when we have scoff laws on one side of our ledger, but they're getting work on the other side, where we have people that have not paid their taxes getting contracting work with ODOT. And it has never, and I just use that as an example, it has never struck me that out there in agency land, they take that sharing of information very seriously. And I would love to be proven wrong, but it seems to me that if there are huge delinquencies, there ought to be a pretty urgent attempt to reel in some of that money or at least stop the scoff laws from doing business with the state until it's rectified.
Coacher Johnson will certainly provide that information. Most of the work on the collection side is being done by the group at DAS, the Statewide Accounts Receivable Management Group. Part of that is because, for instance, the Interagency Compliance Network is seven agencies that really deal with employee-employer situations. So, for instance, ODOT is not a part of that group and doesn't really fit in with a lot of the enforcement side, yet they do have a lot of contracts with private businesses.
Well, and I applaud the enforcement part to get all Oregonians to shoulder their share of the tax burden and the compliance burden. But I also think that we ought to have some kind of a dragnet for the scoff laws so that they're not rewarded by having the opportunity to be in the state's book of business if they're not paying their taxes or honoring their obligations. So I'd be interested in knowing more about that. And the other thing that you talked about is that conversations have been had about a countywide lien system, but it just seemed insurmountable. What's the status of that?
Coacher Johnson, that's another topic that's been discussed among a number of agencies working with DAS with that the SWARM, the Statewide Accounts Receivable Management Group. There were legislative proposals in prior sessions, and my understanding is that they were brought forward and there was concern from the counties about the impact that it would have on their revenue of having a statewide lien registry. So I was not involved with those discussions when they were brought forward previously, but that's what I've heard from others that were.
I'm going to ask our professional staff to capture that as well. I'd like to see a little leadership out of DAS. I share Representative Gomberg's outrage that we've got $3.5 billion worth of delinquent accounts, and it seems like we got a lot of committees talking about it, but we don't have anybody doing anything. So, Representative Gomberg.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing my outrage, Madam Chair. And I've got one last question, and then I know we need to probably move on, but this is important stuff. Mr. Christenfeld, my understanding is that our ability to attach income tax refunds is a relatively new opportunity based on improvements that we've made in our IT system. But I also understand, if I'm not mistaken, that opportunity to pursue income tax refunds is not available when we transfer that debt to collection agencies. Could you talk, if my two understandings are correct, and if they're not, please correct me, but could you talk for a moment about how much of our debt we're sending off to collection agencies and can't use that new opportunity as opposed to how much we're keeping in-house and pursuing?
Certainly, Co-Chair Gomberg, and I'm going to speak specifically about the unemployment insurance debt, which is what I'm familiar with. We have had the ability for a few years to refer some types of debt there. It started out with only overpayments that were caused by fraud. It's now been expanded to include other types of overpayments and delinquent tax debts. There are some limits at the federal level of the types of debts that we can refer over, but we are sending over all the debts that the federal government permits us to from the unemployment insurance side. It's true that that tool is not available to private collection agencies. But with unemployment insurance debt, we're actually not permitted to assign our debts to private collection agencies under federal law until we have determined that the debt is uncollectible. So we pursue those offsets at both the state and federal level, and only if we're not collecting anything there do we refer it. So it's a pretty small percentage of our debt that we refer to those private collection agencies.
All right, that's very interesting. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think it's particularly interesting that we're only giving private business the debt that we've decided can't be collected.
Yeah. All right, on that cheery note, move along, please.
Thank you, and I'll try to make up some of the time, so certainly if you have questions about some of this, let me know, but I want to respect the time that you need to hear from others who are here also. So this is just kind of a visual representation of the state UI taxes going to workers and then back to local businesses, and the federal unemployment tax that then is used to provide administrative grants to states to operate unemployment and other programs. This is just showing our workload, essentially, people receiving benefits. It's easy to see both the impact that the recession had at the very top of that peak, the gradual recovery that we've had, and I mentioned that you can see the seasonal workload spikes. Those are those little periodic bumps in the lines by the year numbers. So every winter we do get an increase in business. So the two things to take away here, one is on this slide, which is that our workload is down very significantly from the peak of the recession. The other on this next slide is that it is still a significant amount of work. So last year, those low levels represent about 1.7 million weeks of benefits being paid, 125,000 workers, and over $500 million in unemployment insurance benefits, hundreds of thousands of phone calls, and collecting just under $1 billion in payroll taxes. So it's very low workload compared to the recession. It's still a lot of work that we're doing. This, I just wanted to show that we take the decisions we make about benefits seriously, and there are a number of safeguards so that if people disagree with the decisions that we make, they have opportunities to challenge those. They can request an impartial hearing with the Office of Administrative Hearings. From there, it can go to the Employment Appeals Board and then into the judicial court system. And at each stage, the numbers in parentheses are just the number of decisions issued at that level, showing that it is it narrows down pretty quickly from the very large number of people seeking benefits to how many are contested at each level.
Do you track the outcomes for those 32 that went to the Court of Appeal? How many found in favor of the agency versus the appellant?
Co-Chair Johnson, we do. I don't have those numbers offhand. One of the things that we track closely is our reversal rate, and we do pretty well there compared to other states. The average nationally is at about 34.5% of the decisions that are appealed to the equivalent of the Office of Administrative Hearings are reversed. In Oregon, our rate is 26.1%. Part of that is because at the hearings, they tend to get both sides together at once and they get more information. And part of it is that some of it does rely on judgment calls about who to believe when you're getting conflicting stories about what happened. We do also track how many allow and deny, but to some extent it depends on the type of issue we're looking at.
Thank you. Okay.
I want to take just a moment to talk about the trust fund system in Oregon because this is very important and it's something that has stood Oregonians very well. We have a statutory system that the legislature enacted that makes a self-balancing tax structure. The numbers at the top of this are the tax schedule that we were in each year. We have 8 schedules. The higher the number, the higher the average tax rate. It's designed so that as the trust fund is more able to withstand the need for benefits, employer tax rates go down. As those benefits are depleted, then the tax rates go up to replenish the trust fund with a little bit of lag built in there. And this actually shows that that worked even during this last recession, which lasted so long. Employer tax rates didn't start to go up until the year when we had hit the bottom of the recession. That's different than many other states when they were starting to raise employer taxes in the middle of the recession as it was still getting worse. The other really important takeaway here is that our trust fund stayed above that bottom line of zero there. We were one of only 17 states in the nation that did not have to borrow money to pay benefits. And while other states are increasing employer taxes still, California owes $3 billion in borrowed money to pay benefits. And other states are also cutting benefits to workers to try to make up that difference. Oregon has retained the benefit levels for workers, and our trust fund is now at the equilibrium point where it is projected to take in as much in tax revenue as it is paying out. So employer tax rates have gone down for the past few years and are holding steady at that equilibrium point now.
Senator Monroe.
States that have debt and have to borrow, can they still borrow from the feds for zero interest?
Co-Chair Johnson, Senator Monroe, during the Great Recession, they were able to do that for a period of time. After a couple of years, they did start getting charged interest when Oregon and several other states that had stayed solvent raised that issue, and I think it was recognized. A number of states also borrowed money on the private market. I don't know the exact period of time, but for quite some time now, there have been no interest-free loans outstanding.
Yeah, that always troubled me when they could borrow for zero interest when we're paying the full freight and, in essence, subsidizing those states. Thank you.
Thank you. So there are some challenges in the UI program, and I want to explain. The inset slide is one from my counterpart at the national level overseeing the UI program. And I'm just going to hit really quickly and assure you that the top bullet point is not a problem in Oregon, where it says the program isn't fulfilling its mission. That refers to the states that have had to really significantly cut benefits because their trust fund is not doing well. We do not receive the level of federal funding that we think is appropriate for administering the program. And the federal government also acknowledges that it only sends out about 88% of the money nationally to what it estimates it costs to run the UI program. So that does impact our ability to provide customer service. And the last bullet point on here about needing to modernize our systems is also an issue that is certainly present in Oregon. I mentioned that one of the big moves that we're doing and that UI programs are doing nationally is linking more closely with the rest of the workforce system. That's a big issue. I'm sorry. I was trying to save time by getting ahead of myself. So among the opportunities, what we're really doing is trying to be more efficient. The big challenge that we're having is providing the service as quickly as we would like while maintaining the quality and improving that. One of the things I did want to point out is that we do have a key performance measure that measures efficiency. Historically, it has looked at the cost of running the UI program to the number of claims filed. We're proposing to modify that to instead compare it to the amount of benefits paid out. The reason for that is we just think it's a more accurate way of viewing it. During the recession especially, how long claims lasted and benefits paid and how difficult it was to administer varied greatly depending on how many extensions there were. We are making progress on serving people more quickly, but it continues to be probably our primary challenge and something that our systems do make more difficult. I mentioned getting out to integrating with the rest of the workforce system. Some of the key things here is we have staff at the frontline levels and at the leadership levels where we meet to talk about what the UI program is doing and how it can link with other parts of the workforce system, so we're aimed in the right direction. You heard from Jim Farr yesterday about the second bullet point, which is actually a UI program, but his staff do most of the work because they have the expertise and they're having that one-on-one contact with people getting benefits to make sure they're meeting eligibility requirements and that we're getting them back to work as quickly as we can. We've also been involved with a number of pilot projects to look at innovative ways to help get people back to work that are beyond the traditional UI requirement, and that includes working with some of the a local workforce development board. I believe you may hear a little bit more about that later today. I had a slide talking a little bit about the interagency compliance network, but I actually think I spoke to that a little bit in response to your question earlier, Co-Chair Johnson. Some of the big accomplishments that we have had in the past year or so has been significantly improving the quality of the benefits decisions that we issued. Some of those innovations, besides working with a local workforce development board, we're also involved with a pilot project with workforce operations and other partners, including the White House's social and behavioral sciences team, to find ways to help people get back to work more quickly. We made that WorkShare program more able to deal with the increased demand when there's the next economic downturn. And we did update our phone system as well, which provides us a lot more functionality and flexibility to deal with the public.
How did you increase the quality of your benefits decisions?
The way that we went about it, there's a few things. One was a focus on the training, both the initial training and doing more oversight, more review of the decisions that are issued so that we can spot issues sooner, provide more guidance to staff when errors have been made. We look at the decisions that are overturned on appeal. We randomly pull selections and have people review them to see if there are additional training needs or errors. Our new phone system also records all of the calls that are made, which it previously did not, so that gives us a very valuable tool to be able to listen to the calls and give more guidance about how to handle situations.
Great. Okay.
So, again, I don't think most of this is new, that our focus is on trying to serve people more quickly while maintaining the improved quality that we've achieved. The WIOA, the federal legislation that you heard Kay and Jim talk about a little bit yesterday, puts a big demand for using the UI data in the rest of the workforce system, so we're working closely with them on that. There is a statutory Employment Department Advisory Council. We've expanded the membership and the viewpoints represented on that council so that it's a little broader, and we're having them be more involved with oversight of our performance and of the policy issues that we're considering. And then the big ongoing improvement is the modernization. I did want to just show a couple pictures that demonstrate.
Go back to the other slide, though. Your advisory council, who are those people, and how do they come to your attention? How are they selected? How are they kept in your loop? What do they do?
Coacher Johnson, we recently had significant turnover from terms expiring. We worked with the outgoing council members and other stakeholders, so there are four representatives of employers, four representatives of workers, and up to two public members. So we make it a point to have representatives from labor, from businesses. We have AOI represented on there. We also have third-party administrators, which are a group that represents lots of businesses in unemployment insurance issues. We have tribal governments represented. We also have one member that's there to represent traditionally underrepresented populations. So Legal Aid Services is providing that viewpoint.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Reardon.
Thank you. On the top item, serving the public more timely, when we chatted before, and you were kind enough to try to help educate me, and to appreciate, you talked about working with other agencies, with several agencies. So does that measure talk about their interaction with simply the employment office, or if a customer has five transactions, does that talk about how they're served across the agencies?
Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Reardon, what I was referring to at this point was really just the direct providing of the UI services, so taking the claims, how quickly we can answer the phones and make those decisions and get the benefits into the people's hands. We do work closely with others, but that's not what this was particularly referring to.
Okay. Thank you for your clarification.
So I just want to leave these pictures with you of what the systems look like that our staff are using. They have multiple systems that they have to have open at once to handle a single claim. This is fake data because we take confidentiality very seriously. But this is what it looks like when our staff are taking claims, where they have to do a lot of manual processes, screens that are not very easy to use, things that can take multiple days with overnight processing in between. So it leaves lots of opportunity for inefficiency and for error. This is on the benefit side. On the tax side, we also have pictures of people that are using our microfiche machine, which we do still use, and of staff having to hand key in some of the paper payroll reports that we receive from employers. So we think that there's lots of opportunities to both build in safeguards to avoid errors and also to become more efficient. I want to very briefly touch on the one policy bill that we have, which is Senate Bill 42. This is really a house cleaning, but a very technical one. In 2016, Senate Bill 1534 was passed. It made a small change allowing a pretty small group of people who normally can't get benefits during summer and other school break periods to receive benefits. It only applied to people that did not provide instructional services. Recently, the federal government issued guidance that requires that change to be made, but it actually applies to all employees of educational institutions. This bill, Senate Bill 42, will repeal the bill from the prior year because, as written, it would be very confusing. It would look like that change only applies to people that do non-instructional work, and it really applies to all employees of educational institutions. With the repeal of 1534, we do have the statutory authority to implement that mandatory federal change, and we're working on doing that through rulemaking.
With the change of administrations, might that change again?
Co-Chair Johnson, that's possible. I do not think it's very likely. This change came out late in December. I haven't heard any discussion at the federal level about it being under review. And it's something that I think had been in the works for quite some period of time. If it does change, we would be able to likely, because we can't predict exactly how they would change it, but it's likely that with the repeal of 1534, if there is a change in federal direction, that we'd be able to accommodate that through rulemaking, or if not, we would come back for a statutory change.
So just to make sure that I understand that this in compliance with federal regulation, anybody in the school system now can apply for unemployment during the summer months?
Coach Johnson, this is actually a pretty narrow exception. Generally, people who work for schools usually cannot get benefits during school breaks. This exception that we're talking about said that if someone had voluntarily quit their job, had a good reason for doing so, so they were receiving benefits. Previously, they would stop getting benefits during the school breaks and then resume getting them after the break period was over. This change just stopped that and said if you were getting benefits, they don't stop during the winter break.
Or spring break or any of the other breaks.
Correct.
Okay. Cool. Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that
Thank
it?
You. It is. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Ms. Erickson.
So, Coach R. Johnson. And committee members, throughout the course of our testimony, you've heard reference to the department's key initiative to modernize our business practices and information technology systems to better serve the needs of our customers and to improve data security. The goal of our modernization initiative is to evaluate, improve, and replace core business and computer systems, including those that support unemployment insurance, taxes, and benefits, and workforce operations, employment services, and labor exchange activities. Over time, this effort will impact the entire department, our customers, partners, and stakeholders. Our core systems supporting unemployment insurance functions were designed in the 1990s, long before the widespread use of the internet to transmit information or conduct business. These are mainframe systems written in COBOL programming language, and it is becoming increasingly difficult to hire IT staff with skills in legacy applications. Even our newest system, our labor exchange system, was designed 13 years ago. And so I don't think I need to tell you how much business has changed in the last decade. Of course, business needs continue to change and continue to evolve, making our business processes increasingly more inefficient as we have to deploy workarounds because we are limited by our aging infrastructure. Business process and data needs are also becoming more integrated, and our systems lack the agility to respond really to today's expectations. So, and finally, our current systems lack sufficient data security in today's world of ever-increasing sophisticated cyber attack. Thank you. So I'm sure the points I'm making are not news. We're not the only agency or the only state with an aging infrastructure. Many of our sister agencies across the country are also modernizing. And what this map shows is that state UI programs are really at different places in their modernization efforts. And Oregon is neither at the front or the back of this national trend, which really gives us some advantage. We're in a position to learn from early states' mistakes and to take advantage of the fact that there are now a number of vendor products that are available for consideration in the marketplace. We last provided an update on our modernization initiative to this subcommittee during the February 10, 2016 session. And to kind of recap and bring you up to date to where we are now, we have an executive level steering committee that meets twice monthly. We have a contract for project management services. We've met with representatives of Oregon and Washington agencies who have successful modernization initiatives to ask them questions, examine their organizational structures, and identify best practices and key learnings. In late November, so just 3 months ago, we hired a modernization initiative manager and three business analysts, and we contracted with the IT Support Center to begin and conduct a feasibility study. The IT Support Center is part of the National Association of State Workforce Agencies, and it's affiliated with the U.S. Department of Labor. They're a nonprofit organization, that knows our business well and works with other states in their modernization planning. And we are working with them to develop a strategic plan and a review of the market options available now. So we're currently utilizing current employees, existing employees, as subject matter experts as needed to work with the IT support center. And we're beginning to define business processes and system requirements. We, of course, will continue to work with the Office of the State CIO, the Chief Financial Office, and the Legislative Fiscal Office as we gain momentum with this initiative. This, you can see from this slide that we expect modernization to take more than one biennium. This high-level timeline shows that we expect to complete the feasibility study by the end of this year, so 6 months into the next biennium. The feasibility study really lays the groundwork to move forward with the formal stage gate process. So you can see below on the slide what's included in that. And then to the left of the little blue box, the request for proposal development, solicitation, and the beginning of the vendor selection process really extends into the 2019-21 biennium.
Are there any states that have best practices or systems where we can just appropriate their work? Do we have to start with a blank piece of paper?
We're, Senator Johnson, Co-Chair Johnson, we're, the reason we're contracting with the IT Support Center is that they have that knowledge base. So they're part of the National Association of State Workforce Agencies. So the other agencies across the nation that do our work, they've helped other states with their modernization efforts. They know our business. They know the laws. They work with the U.S. Department of Labor. So we're not exactly starting from the beginning. And of course, what we hope is once we've identified our business processes and done the gap analysis and figured out what's available in the marketplace, that we will be able to take advantage of that learning and just buy as much as we can off the shelf, right?
How much money have you spent to this point?
To this point, we have spent, I should know this, I think we're authorized to spend $4 million in this biennium. We project to spend about $2 million. We're asking for an additional about $6.5 million for this current biennium. So,
inclusive or exclusive of the two?
Exclusive, additional. So through the end of the next biennium, we would expect to have spent about $11 million, if I'm doing my math right.
So we will have $11 million into thinking about getting going.
We will have $11 million into doing the groundwork that's required to do any kind of major IT projects of this size. So what's happening now is we're documenting processes. We're looking at looking for a document to see where we are. In order to buy something, you have to know what it is you're doing, and you have to know what it is they're capable of doing. Oregon has actually a more integrated system than other states that have gone before us in modernization. So other states, some of them, have ended up doing, again, standalone systems for UI tax, UI benefits, and workforce operations.
Have you had any conversation with the director of the Department of Revenue or
Yes.
any of the principals involved in their modernization program?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the woman that we hired as our modernization initiative program manager is their second in charge for their core system replacement, Renee Royston, who's been with the Department of Revenue's project since the beginning. So we're importing whatever knowledge we can.
Have you discussed with her the fact that customer performance has dropped to an all-time low since that new system was put in?
No, I have not.
You might want to do that.
Certainly we will.
Okay.
So we are at the very beginning of this initiative, Co-Chair Johnson. We're really at pre-stage gate, and we will learn more as we go along. And of course,
what I would like to have, because we see these, we the legislature see these in isolation over a number of years, and you're probably presenting at the technology committee and you're probably presenting in other places. I'd like to see something a little more developed than this. I'd like to see some costs put with it. We will have spent $11 million to get to the stage gate point in the development, and I'd like to see your projections out over what period of time this is going to take and how much you expect to spend.
Certainly. Senator Johnson, the $11 million, by the time we will have spent that, we would likely be through stage gate 2 and 3. Okay. Of the process, right? So it's not all pre-planning. And for the committee, I brought a very high-level timeline. Certainly there are many artifacts already that we've produced at a much higher level of detail that I would, I'd be happy to share.
Okay. Good. All right. Does that conclude your presentation?
One more slide.
Okay.
Oops, did I go? Yeah. So this is the structure that we're looking at currently that supports the policy package in our budget document. It establishes 24 positions, some of which are carry-forward positions from those that we have working on the project currently. Some of them are administrative support functions, business support functions, and really the largest amount of the positions are subject matter experts, which how we intend to work it will be new hires that will do core business services, mostly in unemployment insurance, and then we will pull current staff as subject matter experts out of those areas to participate on the project team as needed. So that concludes the employment department proper portion of the presentation. So I'd like to invite Gary Tyler up then, the Chief Administrative Law Judge of the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Representative Rudin.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the 23, 24 people on here, and I keep getting this kind of queasy feeling. And you talked about 15 of them, I think, would be the subject matter experts. Did you look at other ways to extract that information from the organization? Are there other ways to do that? I've done enough product development. I'm very concerned about people just like running into each other and doing redundant efforts and all of that. So in the interest of efficiency, are there other ways to approach that part of characterizing? I think you're trying to characterize, you know, what do we need to do here? What are the processes? And, you know, does it take 15 people in 2 years? How did you talk about that a little bit?
So Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Reardon, the way I imagine this will work is that these positions are the subject matter expert positions specifically are the type of positions that we regularly hire and that we have a regular turnover in to provide our core business services. So we do a regular amount of hiring all of the time. These positions are, so the positions that would move to the project team would be experienced employees, and because we have old mainframe systems and many manual processes, it's the best way we have to get at the information about what are you doing and why are you doing it and how can we automate that. Does that answer your...
I see a follow-up.
Madam Chair, thank you. No, and I can't really characterize the question adequately here. I'm just a lot of concerns about using their subject matter experts, but are they computer design experts? How do we really identify what the project customer requirements, if you will. So that's part of it. Also, do we need to buy new computers to do our old way of business? You know, maybe there's new systems out there that actually do it much better, and I would hope so for all these millions of dollars. So those are the questions I'm trying to get at. I don't expect a complete answer, but I wanted to express those concerns before we decide to go out and spend all this money.
Coacher Johnson, Representative Reardon, I appreciate your concerns. We have no interest in hiring positions that don't add value. We have limited funds, one-time funds, to replace these core systems. We don't have another revenue source available, so we will be closely monitoring how we spend the money, how we move forward with the project, and again, our choice of the vendor, the IT support center, from our national, that works with our national association and the U.S. Department of Labor. The intent of choosing them is to gain that expertise as well. We will be doing, as part of the feasibility study, a market analysis. So what's available in the marketplace now? And in fact, I think starting next month, we're going to start bringing in vendors just to give us a sense of what's possible. The intent is to have as many employees as possible participate in those vendor displays, because again, we don't want to be limited by our current knowledge of practices, right? We want to get the best knowledge and what's available in the market now, or when we get to that point, which will be, you know, a couple years from now.
Well, thank you. I feel slightly less queasy, but
Is it traditional that you would bring in vendors ahead of time and sort of beauty pageant them, or I'm just curious how you avoid developing an early bias that might reflect badly on an objective selection process?
Coacher Johnson, I think that's a fair question. What we're trying to weigh is let's bring the vendors in early enough that they open up our thinking to what's possible, and keep it far enough away from when we're doing the actual request for proposal.
I can make that easy for you. It'll be what's possible. Our system is your only answer. Yeah.
Certainly, but if you have 15 people come in and tell you that, then you have some breadth of knowledge of what's actually possible.
Are you paying to have them come in, or are they on their own?
They would be on their own.
Good. And Representative Nierman.
I'm just going back. I'm confused about what is the IT support center?
So the Coacher Johnson, Representative Nierman, the IT Support Center is a nonprofit organization that is funded in part by National Association of State Workforce Agency dues. So other state agency programs that are in our business, right, other employment departments and unemployment insurance departments across the nation. They work closely with the U.S. Department of Labor as well, and they've carved out kind of a niche business in helping states think strategically about modernizing their old legacy systems.
Okay, good. I want to leave enough time to testify for the public to testify, but I would very much appreciate the opportunity to hear from the Chief Administrative Law Judge. So please commence your testimony, Your Honor.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. I'm Gary Tyler. I'm the Chief Administrative Law Judge with the Office of Administrative Hearings. We do receive our administrative support from the Employment Department. Our internal mission for the Office of Administrative Hearings is to serve the public by providing impartial, fair, and efficient contested case hearings to the agencies, businesses, and individuals throughout Oregon. The office is managed by the Chief Administrative Law Judge, who was appointed by the governor. We are
overseen and monitored by the Office of Administrative Hearings Oversight Committee. This is a 9-member committee created by the legislature, consisting of 2 representatives appointed by the governor, 2 by the president of the Senate, 2 by the Speaker of the House of Representatives, 2 by the Attorney General, and the Chief Administrative Law Judge sits as the ex officio member to complete that 9-member committee. A major function of that committee is to make recommendations to the governor and the legislative committee or legislative assembly that the committee deems necessary to increase the effectiveness, the fairness, and the efficiency of the operations of the Office of Administrative Hearings. The Chief Administrative Law Judge sets the fees that establish to recover the cost of providing hearings on behalf of the various agencies throughout the state. Here you see the internal organization within the Office of Administrative Hearings. We have 5 major program areas internally, the Employment Department being the largest body of work that we do, but we also do work for the Department of Transportation, primarily with implied consent hearings, and also for the Department of Justice, Division of Child Support, and for the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority, and a number of different kinds of programs that we train for in that area. And then the final section are other programs, which consist of over 60 different smaller agencies, boards, and commissions.
If I may interrupt you for just a second. At one time, there was an attempt for agencies to try to flee out of this centralized panel. How are you doing in terms of adding other agencies where you're providing ALJ services or in having people try to flee the jurisdiction?
We did have the Construction Contractor Board remove their contested case hearing process back to the circuit court system so that they were totally out of that picture the last time around. I'm not currently aware of anyone trying to flee. We do have contracts, as we're authorized to do, with several different entities, including the Employment Department, the Division of Child Support, and Oregon Youth Authority now has asked us to come in and do hearings for them. And the Department of Education, we do special education hearings by contract with them as well. So we've picked up some of the agencies that aren't even required to use us. So I think that bodes
well. I think that bodes well.
Yes.
Yeah, good. Thank you. Please continue.
So our key drivers for the Office of Administrative Hearings are our referrals. And you can see over the years they fluctuate. Most of the fluctuation is due to the change in UI and unemployment insurance referrals peaking out during the recession at about over 2,000 per month. And then down currently to somewhere around 916 referrals a month. So being a central panel, we can adjust to that by shifting some of our administrative law judges to other program areas where there might be an increase in the number of requests coming in. Currently, we've seen some request increase in the social services kinds of programs for the Department of Human Services. This slide represents the breakdown of the major program areas, and you can see that 60% of the referrals that we receive come from the Employment Department, primarily from unemployment insurance-related requests. For the Department of Transportation, these are mostly implied consent hearing requests. And then for child support referrals, have to do with determining the amount of child support primarily. For the Department of Human Services and Office of Medical Assistance Program areas is the major area there. And then the other program areas, which here only represent 2% of our referrals, but are our most complex cases, and those include the licensing boards and the the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, Water Resources Department, for example, and 60 other.
May I ask you, in the interest of time, to sprint to the finish?
Please. I will do it. The next slide just shows you how the expenditures break down, and this is a reflection of the complexity. So the greater percentages the greater the complexity of the cases that we have. This slide represents where we travel throughout the state of Oregon. So our administrative law judges travel to all these points to provide in-person hearings. There are about 52 different locations. We travel about 100,000 miles a year, mostly conducting in-person implied consent hearings, which are mandated by statute to be within 100 miles of where the arrest site is. This slide represents the number of hearing participants and where they originate. So they come from all the counties throughout the state of Oregon. This represents the 2013-15 biennium and 54,000 participants from throughout the state. Most of these hearings, I would say, are conducted by telephone, so that's an efficiency that we achieve. The accomplishments that we've had since we last talked, we currently dispose of about 20,000 or 25,000 hearing dispositions a year for over 70 agencies, boards, and commissions, and we now have a case management system that allows us real-time access to documents in case status, and we can share that with all of our participants. And by the end of this biennium, we will have all of the agencies, boards, and commissions on board. We're just wrapping that up right now. We're coming in at under our estimated budget for the total project, and we're very pleased with what's resulted there. The challenges that we face have to do with the fluctuations in the hearing referral types that we receive. So one of the KPMs for us is the cost per referral, and that in the height of the recession, that was at $384 a referral. Now that we have about 13,000 less unemployment insurance referrals a year, that cost has gone up per disposition to about $500. We're asking for a change in that KPM to reflect the forecast. So the old target is based on a formula that just changes a little bit every year, and we're trying to base it on a forecast that more accurately captures what we think our costs are going to be. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, any questions? Thank you. In the interest of time, I'm going to ask the three of you to withdraw, and I'm going to bring up two three-person panels. We're going to start with Denise McCarthy, Caitlin Roberts, and Lauren Holm will be the first panel.
Yes.
You don't have to hear from Bass.
Make them wait. I'm going to make them wait.
Okay.
Okay, please go ahead and start. I've run us dangerously close to out of time, so whoever wants to start, please go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Denise McCarthy. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Bioscience Association, and my request today is that your continued funding of the Oregon Talent Council. In 2016, Oregon Bioscience published its fourth economic impact study, and through that study we learned, and that's for fiscal or for calendar year in 2014. So these numbers are not including the incredible accomplishments of OHSU and the Knight Campus Cancer Fund that was met. So we learned through that study in 2014 that 49% of bioscience entities reside outside of the Portland metropolitan region, and almost every single county in our state has a bioscience entity in it. We've experienced steady and significant growth inside of our bioscience sector, and one of the reasons that I'm asking you to continue to fund the Oregon Talent Council is to meet that workforce requirement. The Oregon Talent Council fulfills a need, a gap in workforce training that's outside of your standard STEM and CTE training and university training. My organization applied, and I'm happy to report, received an Oregon Talent Council grant in 2016. With that, we were able to spread our existing workforce training program across the state, and we started in Central Oregon with partners with Intel, and with actually Cascade Workforce Investment Board. So we were able to hold classes in Bend and also in Redmond, and also now classes inside of Eugene and Corvallis. So my request to you again is that your continued funding of the Oregon Talent Council to meet the requirements for not only our industry, but we also stretch geographically and also across sectors. We're now training organizations that come out of the technology sector, software development, also food manufacturing, because we have quality assurance and FDA requirement training as well. So that's my request. Thank you.
How much was that grant, and how much did you retain for administrative services?
Wow. It was $750,000, the grant, and I can say that there was a one-to-one match from private, mostly from private industry, and also from some universities, and administrative numbers I'd have to come back to. I don't have that off the top of my head.
That'd be fine if you would. That would be great.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Holm.
Co-Chairman Johnson, Co-Chairman Gumberg, my name is Lauren Holm. I live in the great town of Scappoose. I'm the lead recruiter.
You think that was coincidental?
Oh, it was planned. Okay. I'm the lead recruiter with Rightaway. Rightaway is a trucking company, transportation company, headquartered in Tualatin. I'm on here behalf of the veteran representatives for Oregon Employment Department. I have a great relationship with the vet reps throughout the state. We have a network to where they provide referrals of veterans looking for opportunities when it comes to not just driving, but also clerical, dock workers, warehouse, what have you. We're in constant contact on a regular basis. They've been extremely supportive when it comes to referrals. We have hires from that network. In my particular situation, I was unemployed. I'm retired United States Army. I was unemployed.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you, ma'am. Appreciate it. I was unemployed, received an email from a vet rep in regards to a position with, well, he just asked if I could, if he would be allowed to submit my resume. It turned out to be with Rightaway. I said yes, okay, and I got hired. It worked, it segued. So, segued into a partnership with the vet reps throughout the state. We have six terminals throughout the state: La Grande, Portland, Roseburg, Bend, Medford, and Eugene. So it's a great network, great working relationship, and I truly appreciate the dedication they provide on a regular basis when it comes to helping veterans find employment. By the way, I am a recruiter, and I look out here and I see potential truck drivers.
I can tell you the pay driving trucks probably better than the pay that we get as legislators.
No doubt about it.
Sure, ma'am. I do have brochures on hand if you're interested.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Ms. Roberts.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, and members of the committee. My name is Caitlin Roberts. I'm the operations manager for Northwest Oregon Works. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today. Northwest Oregon Works is the local workforce development board that oversees the investment of funds into the public workforce system for Columbia, Blackhawk, Tillamook, Lincoln, and Benton counties. There are three areas I want to touch on today. Our partnership with the Oregon Employment Department, our work in coordinating sector partnerships, and the Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center. First off, our partnership with the Oregon Employment Department is paramount to the success of meeting the needs of businesses and individuals in the Northwest area. As Jim Farr spoke with you yesterday in his presentation, we have worked really closely with the Oregon Employment Department to implement the WorkSource Oregon operational standards. These standards ensure a more customer-centered workforce system. They also ensure that no matter what door an individual or business walks through, they'll get the same level of service. So within our five-county area, there are six WorkSource centers, and we are working really closely with the Oregon Employment Department to have a more robust center in Lincoln City. Secondly, I wanted to talk about the work we're coordinating with the sector partnerships. Sector partnerships, we're working to convene workforce, education, economic development, and other community organizations in order to listen and address the needs of businesses within the same industry and the same labor market area. So currently, there is a thriving sector partnership within the advanced textile manufacturing industry in Columbia County. Tony Erickson with Oregon Arrow, along with a number of other committed businesses, are leading this partnership work. And we are working to pursue grant opportunities in order to support this partnership. The goal is to purchase industrial sewing equipment in order to operationalize training curriculum that was developed by the businesses and successfully tested. So we're working on that all together. The other two sector partnerships emerging in the area are healthcare. It right now is focused in Benton and Lincoln counties and being championed by Dr. Larry Mullins, President and CEO of Samaritan Health Services. The last emerging partnership is within the maritime industry. Lincoln County Commissioners Doug Hunt and Terry Thompson have initiated a conversation with regional solutions, business leaders in that industry, community colleges, the Oregon Employment Department, and my organization. And we're going to be assisting in coordinating efforts and resources, not just within our five-county area, but also in Lane, Coos, Curry, and Douglas counties. So lastly, I just want to briefly mention the Oregon Manufacturing Center. This is a great, exciting project happening in Columbia County. I'm sure you all are aware. We are working with the Oregon Employment Department and the various other organizations involved to coordinate resources in order to support this endeavor. We will be ensuring that the WorkSource Centers and other workforce system partners have the knowledge and tools they need to connect businesses and individuals to the center for the opportunities that it will provide. So thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Senator Hansel.
Would some of you move from Columbia County out to Umatilla County?
You think this was a complete coincidence that two of them are from Columbia County? Thank you very much. Any other questions of this panel?
Do we have other people testifying?
We have three other people that are signed up.
Oh, wait.
Okay. Thank you very much. The next panel, Sherry, and I apologize that I cannot read your last name. Thank you. Jean Vander Merkel and Charles Baldwin. Good afternoon. Please start.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Gomberg and members of the committee. My name is Sherry H., and I am the Rethinking Job Search Facilitator for WorkSource Portland Metro Southeast. And with me is
Gene Vander Merkel. I'm a resident of the state of Oregon, live in Multnomah County, and I am a volunteer for the research study.
Okay, and so Rethinking Job Search is a federally funded program using workforce innovation monies to deliver a series of educational workshops over the course of a month, meeting three times a week for 2 hours each week at 10 WorkSource centers throughout Oregon. And the purpose and goal is to address the social, emotional consequences of being unemployed. The focus is on understanding how your thinking impacts what you do and how that impacts how soon you become employed again. And so in order to be eligible, participants have to be 18 years and older. They must be collecting Oregon unemployment benefits and have a high school diploma or GED. So the cognitive behavioral training techniques are lessons on how your thinking impacts what you feel and how that affects what you do. Goal setting, the thought-feeling link, being responsible, accountable, and credible to what you do and to yourself. And also, most importantly, building confidence and self-esteem. The behavioral stances is something that we also cover in terms of choosing your actions and what you do. And the goal is to get people reemployed as soon as possible with increased retention rates. And so we, to date, have served about 458 people here in Oregon in this program. And it's born out of a study in the UK, Australia, and Canada that has been really successful. And she will tell you his personal experience with it.
Let me just ask so I understand. Are you part of the employment department, or are you a vendor that receives pass-through grant funds from the agency?
I'm a vendor. I work for WorkSource Portland Metro Southeast Works.
And is that a private not-for-profit?
It is.
Okay. Thank you. And what's the size of the contract that you have with the Employment Department?
I am responsible to serve about 75 participants over the course of a year. And so at this point, I've met my numbers.
Okay, and the value of the contract?
I'm not quite sure. I don't want to give you wrong information.
Okay. Thank you. Please, go ahead.
Co-Chair Johnson, Mr. Gomberg, my name is Gene Van Amergo, like I stated, and I was a student in the program, Rethinking Job Program. I went to 12 of the classes, and the onset of the program was rethinking my employment ability. I was continuously employed for almost 18 years with the same employer for 13 years, and I was realizing the fact that I had to do something different. After 3 months of unemployment, you kind of get in a rut, lose self-esteem, lose confidence in your abilities. By joining the program voluntarily, which I received the letter from State of Oregon Unemployment Office, I joined up and I learned several key things about the slippery slope of negative thinking and how it affected my potential of being employed and becoming not only employed but continue to contribute at a high level for my employer. Changing my behavior and how I thought about prospective jobs, what I would do differently as a contributing member of my new employer, and becoming more marketable. Things such as being able to deep think past actions, possibly behavior modification, not getting involved in a slippery slope of inconfidence, and being a better employee. Consequently, I was rehired as a management position by a local employer, which is actually happens to be a worldwide North American employer, and I'm able to continue to apply many of the things I've learned about rethinking employment and how to become a better, not just employee, but a better participant at my position. So one of 458 people that have gained some success out of this, I really think that it should be continue to be supported. The success, my success, is not my success, it's the success of the program, and the further people, the people have also done well with it and will hopefully be able to participate like I have.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Colleagues, any questions? Thank you. Do you mind telling us where you worked when you decided to depart, or if that's too personal, please pass?
I think it's too personal. That's, it's a great Oregon company.
Okay, just let it go.
For the change in management and
that's fine. That's good enough. Mr. Baldwin.
I'm Charles Baldwin. I'm representing Power Oregon. We're an offshoot of Oestra, which in 2012 did a study critical of ETIC, and I'm here to speak about the budget proposal for the Oregon Technology Council. The study that we did in 2012 identified problems with ETIC. We thought they were overspending. They did not, well, we really thought they were base funding for the university system, actually. And they did not have a metrics for identifying placement. They did not have a metrics for measuring the investment outcomes. And so we recommended that either the legislature close ETIC or to replace it with something that would perform for the legislature better. The legislature decided in 2015 to replace ETIC with OTC. And it has been in a process of establishing goals, working with a broader group of Oregon industries, and more involvement with rural communities, and has involved the employers in its research. It has a plan. It will involve and identify employer needs. It will determine the adequacy of state-funded programs and privately funded programs to meet those needs. and will provide a system of measurement to determine the efficacy of those programs. You have before you a proposal that would limit the funding for OTC quite significantly, and very frankly, our recommendation is that you eliminate that budget item altogether rather than approve it. We feel that OTC is there to meet the legislature's needs in measuring the outcomes of the programs that you otherwise fund to promote high growth industries and employment throughout the state. If you can't do that with OTC in meeting the high skill talent needs of industries that require those talents, then we think that you ought to do what you were asked to do back in 2012 and just simply eliminate the function altogether and turn it over to the federal government and let Trump run the show. So if you don't want to have the state involved in a voice for how to develop talent in the state of Oregon through its university system or other junior colleges and systems that employers identify their needs to be, then just leave it up to the feds and let them do it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Baldwin. Any questions, colleagues? Representative Reardon.
Yes, sir. Thank you all for your testimony. And Mr. Baldwin, I'm very concerned about the retaining the Oregon Talent Council and how that might work. And so I'm very interested in your comments. I think, did I hear you? I'm going to get a question in here somewhere, Chair, if you don't mind. So I do believe you were saying you would support the function of the planning. There's planning, there's grants, and there's kind of an outreach program. Would you see value in all three of those, or is there one particular value that you'd like to advocate for?
We think there's a critical value. You already allocate significant monies to support industries throughout Oregon and employment programs throughout Oregon. But one of the high needs, highly identified needs, is for those particular skills in the high growth industries that pay relatively high wages. And we have a shortage of supply for coming out of our university system and other training programs to meet those needs. So our employers in those industries need to go out of state to find their employees if they find them at all. And Oregon faces significant competition, not only nationwide, but now worldwide, for those kinds of skills. And I mean, just the whole debate now about the immigration program and how many permits we're going to issue in the country for high-skill job needs from employers, and the concerns that these employers have over being able to find enough talent to meet their needs to make the kind of growth that Oregon expects them to make. And so we think Oregon should have a system in place to identify the needs from the employers themselves, have some proactive programs that will at least identify them, and to recommend to the legislature how they might be improved to provide and meet those needs. And thirdly, and maybe most importantly, is to determine the efficacy of those programs. There is not that now. You do not have that information before you to consider. And if you don't want OTC to do it and won't fund them to do it, then give it up and let the feds do it for you.
Thank you very much.
May I just comment?
We're over seven minutes, but go ahead.
Madam Chair, thank you for your indulgence. I would try to say what you've just said, but you've said it so much better than I would. I want to go on record as supporting this function of planning. We do a lot of data collection that looks back at our history, what's happening within the state in terms of jobs and employment and so forth. We have nothing else that I know of that looks forward. I think we need to put a headlight on this fast-moving car, and I think that's the OTC that will really help guide our investments going forward. So that's I didn't get a question out of that. I'm sorry. But.
No, and fortunately, we have the research arm of the Employment Department. Thank you all for coming. I'm sorry, committee, that I ran us a little over. Anything for the good of the order, Ms. Deister?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, we did not hear from the CFO's office.
Sorry.
I would say that their slides are on your meeting materials. To the extent that you have the opportunity to look over those or would like to hear from them later on, we may be able to work them into the schedule.
We'll absolutely get you in. I apologize for the oversight. We just bad agenda management. So please review the materials. We'll have them back in for their comments prior to final action on this committee, obviously. Anything else for the good of the order, colleagues? Thank you. We're adjourned.
Right. Yes.